Beaming out across the galaxy, this is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello, you wonderful people, and welcome to the Free Zone. Well, here we are, right before the Super Bowl. Do I even know who's playing? No, I don't. I think it was, what, Patriots and the Falcons. So what are we looking at? You remember when it was Patriots versus the Giants? And all the conspiracy theorists predicted, well, the Giants are going to win because the Patriots have to lose. And, of course, the Elohim, the Giants, did win. So now we're looking at Horus versus the Patriots. And who's going to win? I'm going to go with the Falcons at this point, guys, because, well, you know, Horus is the age that we are in. So we'll go from the Elohim's Giants over to, or the Nephilim, you know, whichever, to the Phoenix or the Falcons, the Horus of that. What will Lady Gaga do? Well, we're going to have a nice discussion about a lot of the topics that I think will be expressed by Lady Gaga and her performance at the Super Bowl. I want you guys to remember that these celebrities are not paid to be at the Super Bowl. They are not paid. They go there simply because millions and millions of people will be watching. So I fully expect Lady Gaga to pull off a transgender, transhumanist, Phoenix Rising extravaganza. That's my prediction at this time. We'll see how close we got. We nailed it with Katy Perry and the last somewhat LGBT extravaganza. I had to laugh at the last Super Bowl, Joseph, because, well, it was very gay. And being that with these sports people, to me, was just such a juxtaposition that I couldn't help but laugh at. But anyway, folks, that is my Y2K prediction. There we go. That's how long I've been doing this. That is how I see the Super Bowl going down. We got the Falcons winning and Lady Gaga in a transgender, transhumanist Phoenix Rising scenario. Now, I want to let you know they have taken over the internet. You guys all know this. And I can see the numbers dwindling already. So realize that they are limiting our engagement. And our only hope is to have you share this information. It's not going to show up in the algorithms. It's not going to show up where it should. I went and Googled my film, Freeman TV, Columbia, and I can't find it. All right? I can't find my own YouTube video with my own name. It just doesn't exist. I mean, it exists, but it's not there. So it's all up to you guys. Share is got to be the motto at this time if we're going to get out, if we're going to get the information. And if you're there on YouTube, click that little bell, get the notifications. I saw the numbers drop as soon as they changed that algorithm and the way YouTube works. So there's a little bell there in the corner. You got to click that thing, all right? That way you're going to get everything. Because you want to share this knowledge. People need to know where the world is going. We are caught up in identity politics. We're caught up in the craziest, name-calling war I've ever seen happen. And we're in the midst of a civil war. And no one, it's craziness, folks. We're seeing social engineering left and right. And so tonight, we are going to discuss all of this, along with some of the space war programs, social engineering television, and moving all the way through all the different ideas that we will finally achieve, the ideas of beauty and what is human. So folks, tonight's guest is Dr. Joseph P. Farrell. He is a meticulous and brilliantly gifted researcher and a prolific author. Oh, my Lord. So many books, from the Giza Death Star to SS Brotherhood of the Bell to Nazi International, Babylon's Bankers, and more recently, The Covert War and Breakaway Civilizations. He holds a doctorate in patristics from the University of Oxford. That's dealing with doctrines of early Christian theologians. And he's published four previous works concerning theology. Joseph pursues his other loves and hobbies as classical music. He plays the organ, the harpsichord, classical music all over, plus just likes to dabble in physics, alternative history, science, and, well, just strange stuff. So please, his website is GizaDeathStar.com. And please welcome to the show Dr. Joseph Farrell. Hey.
Hi. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, it's great always to talk to you, Joseph, because... Well, you know, you're a brother of another mother. Honestly, this breakaway civilization, transhumanism, and the covert wars with social engineering, to me, is the topic of the day. I want to talk to you about what you think about Trump and what is going on. And let's open there, Joseph, if you want to. Let's get political.
Well, Trump, I came to Trump rather reluctantly, as a lot of people do. And I tell people I'm cautiously optimistic, but much more on the caution side.
But all your study of Nazis, I would imagine so.
Yeah. The so far, I think, as far as his the flurry of executive orders that we've seen coming out, I think, for the most part, they're good. What disturbs me about the incoming Trump administration, Catherine Austin Fitz and I have discussed this many times on her show. What disturbs us both is we see a lot of Goldman Sachs people in and around the incoming administration. And that scenario to us, there's really only two ways to interpret it, one very good, one very bad. And there's really not a very good middle ground here. So let's deal with the bad scenario. If you see Goldman Sachs, it's associated with the austerity measures that we've seen put into place by Angela Merkel in Europe vis-a-vis Greece. They were part and parcel during the post-Soviet collapse and then during the incoming Yeltsin government. In Russia, Goldman Sachs, the Harvard Foundation, and so on, literally led the rape of Russia, buying off the old state enterprises there for pennies on a dollar until, of course, Mr. Putin came in and put a stop to it. So we could be looking, you know, the first scenario is we're looking at a scenario of the rape of Russia on steroids. In other words, if you look behind Mr. Trump's desire to reshore not only jobs to this country, which I think is a good thing. You know, the free trade agreements haven't worked out too well for the American middle class. But if you look at his desire to reshore jobs and the capital to make it necessary, and that latter point is the key point, we could be looking at a scenario where they are attempting to rebuild the industrial base of this country to have another run at unipolar empire. So, you know, that's a possibility that everybody has to face that we might be looking at here, just kind of a pause to catch our breath before we go out and try and run the world again. And in the process, you know, privatize a lot of the financial system and government databases and so on, which we've seen already happening at breakneck speed. So that's the bad possibility. And this is why I say I'm more on the caution than the optimism side. But on the other side of it, he does appear to be very serious to mention the good possibility here in some of the things that he wants to do to try and get the middle class going back. And I should preface what I'm about to say with something else. I've been saying for several months, going all the way back to when Mr. Trump first announced his candidacy, that I did not think that this was simply a narcissistic lark on his part, that I thought that there was a certain faction within the American deep state that was definitely behind him, trying to orchestrate things. That faction, for want of a better word, I've been calling the pissed off military intelligence mafia complex. Okay. Because after all, Mr. Trump makes a lot of his money in casinos, real estate, and so on. And Obamacare just literally gutted the discretionary income of the American middle class. And that was very evident. I have a lot of friends still in the casino industry out in Nevada telling me that, you know, they were hit hard, very quickly and very hard by it. So you have that segment that wants to look at its bottom line and sees its bottom line evaporating because of all the federal mandates and so on. And then the other faction is the pissed off military and intelligence part of it, because they've been watching a unipolar empire building strategy for the last 30 years, the last three administrations, Clinton, Bush, and then Obama. And I'd even go back to the first Bush administration, quite frankly. So I've always had it in my mind that Trump's candidacy really represents a factional war going on within the American deep state between supporters of Hillary Clinton, the so-called neocon, neoliberal crowd, and then this disenfranchised group within the deep state behind Mr. Trump. So in other words, I've always viewed this election also as a referendum, much more than an election about personality. It was a referendum.
The rejection election.
Yeah, the rejection election of where we have been and who's been in charge. And it's not doing, you know, it's not doing the lower or middle class in this country any good.
What do you mean by unipolar? I'm sorry, I didn't.
Well, by unipolar, I mean this idea that goes back to Zbigniew Brzezinski's grand chessboard idea that, you know, America was the sole remaining superpower after the collapse of the Soviet Union and should seize the opportunity to remake the world in the way that America wanted to do it. In other words, it was a world revolving around one power, and that was the United States. And of course, we busily pursued that that agenda under the Clinton, Bush, and then Obama administrations. And, you know, we see the result. Virtually everybody in the world doesn't like us anymore, I think for good reason. So that's what I mean by unipolar. But Mr. Trump, in terms of this reshoring enterprise, there's a lot of capital that went offshore during the years immediately prior to and then immediately subsequent to the bailouts. There's a lot of liquidity in corporate coffers and books that are literally sitting offshore that have not, you know, they've been sitting there. This money has not been used to generate any equity or production or anything. And Goldman Sachs would be the perfect group. I mean, they're the people that helped engineer it go offshore, so, you know, they know where it is. So if you want to reshore jobs, and if you want to build up the nation's economy again with actual production equity rather than just finance capital, and I hope people understand my distinction there. But if you want to do that, Goldman Sachs is the perfect group of people to turn to do this. So, you know, looking at this phenomenon within his administration, I have the very what I call the very bad scenarios, you know, reshoring to make the empire great again and have another go at it, the rape of Russia scenario. Or on the other hand of the spectrum, we have an actual serious attempt on Mr. Trump's part to bring things back to this country. And there's really no middle ground here. And the bad part of it is time is going to tell. So far, just looking at what he has been doing in terms of his executive orders and so on, and comparing those to some of his campaign promises, so far it looks like he's very serious. But the real test of the metal is going to be in this whole reshoring infrastructure building project that he has in mind.
We can clearly see the social engineering campaign going down. Those of us that had any knowledge of Hillary Clinton were aghast at the idea of her being dictator.
Well, hear, hear. I was definitely in that column.
I mean, I'm no fan of Trump either.
Yeah, I know. It was.
But now we've got these people that the truthers are calling snowflakes and all other derogatory terms, social justice warriors. I got accused of that. And we're watching this total meltdown of people that feel like their world has just ended. I mean, and when I see what they're after, it really is, I mean, oh God, can I say this openly? Perversion. I mean, it's like, oh my God, we were so close to having the best perverted society there is. And you guys stole it all away with Trump, took away our Hillary. But those of us that know Hillary and know, you know, we're around for Waco, we're around for Mena, Arkansas, right. Drug scams and cocaine.
Vince Foster.
Vince Foster. How many times these guys have been indicted? I mean, you know, those of us, we're looking at these people that are flaking out and going crazy and beating people up. And, you know, that's all social engineering, right?
Well, I think to a certain extent it is. The American left, I think, really has been radicalized in the last 30 years in a way that it, you know, never really was before that. You know, Trump's getting a lot of flack right now for his executive order, which they're touting as a Muslim ban, which, of course, it is no such thing. He has not banned travel from countries with very heavy Muslim populations. He simply targeted certain countries, and he pulled a clever one in just basically using Obama's list to
well,
do
exactly
this.
Right.
You know,
Obama's
so,
bomb list.
Yeah,
you know.
Obama's bomb
okay,
list.
Obama and, bombed all these people. Maybe they shouldn't come here.
Yeah, his ban list is really no more strict or severe than President Carter's. You know, and President Carter wasn't exactly a right winger fascist, but. You know, we're seeing all of this. What we're really seeing is the American left has become so radicalized and so accustomed to power and entitlement that they're, you know, this is their reaction. Plus, a certain amount of it, I do think, is deliberately orchestrated. There's no doubt in my mind that this is pushback from that part of the American deep state that was backing Hillary, that did want to continue things as they were before. And, you know, essentially what they were running was a huge racketeering system. And, you know, the corruption that goes with that is endemic. So this is the other part of the problem. You're dealing with a lot of very powerful, pissed off people that realize that the money that they were making under the old system is it doesn't look to be a very secure source of income for the future. So yeah, there, you know, we're in a huge culture. You said civil war in the introduction. I view this as a culture war.
Yeah, because, much better.
Because we're seeing, you know, we have in this country the tendency to view all of this as simply something confined to the election of President Trump. But it really isn't. You're seeing the same thing in Europe. You've got Marine Le Pen in France saying basically the same thing. We've got to get control of our culture or we're going to lose it all. You see it with Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. You saw a certain element of this with the Brexit vote last summer. You're seeing gigantic pushback now against Angela Merkel, who's been the architect in Europe of all of these open border policies, which I really think might just as well be called cultural suicide policies. I saw an email today of an article that someone sent me that the German government's crime statistics were for immigrants committing crimes in Germany were 142,000 plus crimes. That's about 780 crimes per day.
You
know?
Crazy.
So you can't, you know, to my mind, you can't have a stable government when it's propped up on sheer force. Culture is the model, the assumptive model that we all use to base our daily decisions on. And there has to be rule of law. Everybody has to be subject to the same rule of law. You can't have a two-track society. And when the culture is being deliberately broken down, you know, the decision-making process stops, the money flows stop, trust stops. So Trump to me is kind of really symbolic of a much bigger phenomenon that's been brewing and growing in Western countries, largely as a reaction to the policies of Mr. Globaloney that has been leading these countries for so long, and people are rejecting the policies because they're seeing the results.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was a shocker to everyone, myself included. And I sat up till 3 a.m. to make sure and watch that all unfold. And
yeah, I did too. I personally was not all that surprised. The press in this country was doing its best to maintain that Clinton's campaign was much stronger than Trump's, that he had no chance. And, you know, I was watching Trump's rallies and I'm thinking, you know, where are they getting these?
Where are they getting their numbers?
Yeah. Where are they getting their numbers here when Hillary's vice presidential candidate can't even draw 2 dozen people at a rally? Then
right.
We know that there's a little problem with the numbers, you know, but I wasn't all that shocked, really. I'm more shocked that they think that the voting fraud was all on the side of people and supporters of Mr. Trump rather than Mrs. Clinton, because now it's coming out, if you're really following the stories, that there was a lot more fraud in her column. And I'm questioning whether, you know, I'll be honest, I'm questioning whether she did win the popular vote. And I think the reason that they dropped that one so fast is I think that her support in California was much softer than they want to admit. We need to recall that Senator Sanders, you know, actually had that stolen from him. Right. And there were a lot of Sanders crossover voters for Mr. Trump. And,
right.
you know, so that tells me that what they're afraid of is that California showed very, very soft support and that it wasn't the automatic lock in the blue counties that it was assumed to be. So time is going to tell whether that hunch is true or not. But I suspect that this is the reason they're so hysterical.
Right. Well, you know, they kept talking about the peaceful transfer of power over and over again. That phrase was used. I kept looking for the meaning behind this because, well, even during Trump's inauguration, as he said those words, peaceful transfer of power, a whole host of military came and stood behind him and then just suddenly walked away.
I mean, I even blogged about that. I got to tell you, I thought that very clearly was a message. You know, you had the Obamas there, you had George Walker Bush there. His father couldn't come, apparently, because he was ill. And you had both of the Clintons there. And the military coming up and standing behind him at that precise juncture, I think, was a deliberate message that if you want to come after us, we have, you know, there's more backing Mr. Trump than his own personal ego. There's a lot more backing him, that there's an element of the American deep state that is behind him and watching his back. And that I think was a message directly to the assembled presidents and who they symbolized, because, you know, with the Bushes and the Clintons and the Obamas, you're all there at the same time. They represent that neocon, neoliberal element that's been directing the policy of the country, foreign and domestic, for the last 30 plus years. So to me, that was very symbolic. And, you know, just to add a little cherry to this Sunday that we're making, there were stories prior to the inauguration that just blew my mind. And they were from websites that were fairly credible. Websites like the Vineyard of the Saker, the gentleman that follows Russian politics so closely. There were even stories that Soviet GRU Spetsnaz agents were running security interference for Trump without his knowledge, of course, but, you know, making sure that nothing has happened. And I thought it very strange, too, during the election campaign itself that Mr. Trump retained his own private security. So, you know, he's no fool. He knows that there's going to be a certain faction gunning for him, if I can use the pun. You know, perish the thought. I don't want any leader to be assassinated. But
he boldly walked down Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah, he did. And that too, tells me that there was a lot more going on security-wise behind the scenes. They were letting the snowflakes, you know, shout and scream and have their temper tantrums, you know, let them vent, which I think was an astute political move. Again, Trump is not as politically naive, I think, as people think he is. By letting them do all this, they're just, you know, showing themselves to be what they always have been. So, you know, cracking down on them isn't going to do any good. Just let people see what they really are.
You know? Right.
It's not going to help them.
No.
So, you know, it was a very interesting inauguration because, like you say, there were so many messages and signals and
definite ceremonial pissing.
Yeah, definite ceremonial pissing is a good way to put it.
Oh, my Lord. When Trump walked past them all, boy, I just felt like their shoes were turning yellow.
Well, their toes were certainly curled. Let's put it that way.
Well, Trump made a bold move and threw Elon Musk into the mix. How long before we're all retiring on Mars is what I'm wondering.
Well, Trump is very interesting there. I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, if a space like you, space is a major interest of mine. And we've been watching these stories for years of asteroid mining, mining the moon. And it seems like what began as a slow drip right around the transition from the Bush to the Obama, first Obama administration, that the slow drip became a steady trickle. And to me, this is very interesting, Freeman, because I've been speculating for years and years and years about the existence of a hidden system of finance that was established shortly after World War II to fund covert black projects, technological development over a prolonged period of time to the tune of trillions of dollars. And to make that system work, I've been arguing, and it's a complex argument. People would have to go read the books to and look at all of my talks about the subject because it's very complex. But the short part of it is that if you're going to set up a secret system like that, put it in the hands of the American intelligence community, which President Truman did, in my opinion, if you look at that and then realize that to make such a system work, you'd have to have the participation of certain prime banks in the Western financial system. And how are you going to entice them into doing something like that? Well, the way you would do it would be to secretly collateralize whatever resources are out there in space. So we're looking now, I think, at an incoming administration that definitely wants to make space a major priority at the same time that we've been watching the emergence of space companies like Elon Musk, Richard Branson, Robert Bigelow, all these people, and at the same time that Congress has passed laws that companies can own whatever they recover out there. And the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg has recently done this very same legislative maneuver. And of course, Luxembourg is a big banking hub. So that's telling me, yeah, they're getting ready for something huge in space. Now, this raises a problem because to my mind, the idea of having commercially viable, low risk exploitation of space resources, folks, this just can't be done by chemical rockets. Okay, it's just not feasible with chemical rockets. They cost too much, they're too risky. So this is telling me that perhaps they're getting ready to roll out some of that hidden technology over the next, say, 10 to 20 years, because chemical rockets ain't going to do the job.
I have been hearing rumors of Trump releasing DARPA technologies and even possibly curing cancer.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you mentioned DARPA, just to kind of put what I just said about chemical rockets into a bit of context. Most people do not know, and this will take me a little bit to set up, so I'm going to go around Harvey's barn, as my mother used to say, in order to show people what's going on quietly behind the scenes. In 1998, I think it was, a Mexican physicist by the name of Miguel Alcibiar published a paper in American Journal of Physics or some scientific journal, I don't recall, where he worked out the equations of warp drive, okay? Star Trek. The problem was, in his version of the equations, the metric that he uses, which is basically a kind of geometrical unit within the mathematics of his equations, the metric that he used to create the space warp would have been a mass energy conversion factor of about the size of the planet Jupiter. In other words, it was theoretically possible, but way outside any foreseeable developments within human technology. Then along came a NASA scientist by the name of Dr. Harold Sunny White. And he went in there and looked at Alcubierre's equations and discovered, well, we don't need a metric, a mass energy conversion that big. It would actually only take something much smaller to create an actual space warp, permitting you so-called faster than light travel. So NASA set him up to spearhead the proof of concept experiments to do precisely that. And then DARPA came out, I think about 3 to 4 years ago, with a national scientific technological goal of making, and listen carefully here, folks, this will really shock you, of making the United States warp capable within a century.
Wow. I'm thrown right back to the Star Trek episode where that happened.
Yeah.
That was exactly a big moment, and that was the moment E.T. arrived, all right? That was the day the Vulcan showed up and said, all right, you guys got this warp drive, like people are saying happened with nuclear technologies. Well, you know, they're saying that it's possible the X-37B, you just blew my mind there. I mean, I don't even know. I'm sitting here thinking on that. Like, that's a giant leap. But right now, we've got the X-37B orbiting the planet. It's been up there well over 600 days, going on 2 years. And some reports have said that they were testing this Chinese electromagnetic drive, the impossible drive, as it's been called. Is this relating to that at all?
Well, yes, I think it is. The drive really is not impossible. It was an invention of a British inventor by the name of Roger Sawyer. You can go on YouTube and see him explain his physics thinking behind it. And once you see the explanation, it really isn't impossible at all. It's breaking no known laws of physics. It's just getting thrust from a microwave concave cavity is all it's doing. The Chinese have tested this in space and they have produced thrust from it. So yeah, it's very possible that you're looking at the beginnings of these proof of concept experiments in the technology tree that's eventually going to lead to a very different kind of propulsion system than chemical rockets, which again, you're going to need if you're serious about going out and bringing back resources that you mine from the moon or asteroids or what have you. Everybody's talking about this. And what that's telling me is that, yeah, there's an expectation, at least, of technological development. Frankly, I think probably that some of that technology already exists, and they're just simply creating the climate of public opinion that will be ready to accept it. Because we need to remember something very significant here, Freeman, and that is that anytime you're talking about technologies like that, be it field propulsion for space travel or fusion power or zero-point energy. I just had another email that somebody is actually bringing a commercial fusion reactor online. So kiss the petrodollar goodbye. So in other words, kiss the current financial system that we've been living under for literally 3 to 4 millennia goodbye, because it will change everything. And nobody really has a good idea about what sort of financial system is going to replace it. If you've got energy resources like that, we've been living under a win-lose closed financial system because we've been living under a closed physics system for so long. Physics and finance, in other words, are intimately connected. So this is going to change everything. And how they manage that transition financially, I think, is their key question rather than the technology aspect of it.
Right. Let's not forget, folks, CERN trapped antimatter for, I think, 16 seconds, which is amazing and phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, you thought it was only in Dan Brown novels. No, it really happened. Like, you know, it's amazing what people will take and won't take away from these type of topics. So, you know, we're talking about warp drive and things of that nature. And I often talk about how they use the ground-based antenna array at Cape Canaveral to simulcast the day the Earth stood still to the star Alpha Centauri. And I get challenged on this, Joseph, so much. It's like, well, you had me till you were talking. And it takes you 5 seconds to search that on the internet and find out that I'm telling you the truth. They did send The Day the Earth Stood Still, of all movies, to this most likely inhabited star cluster in Alpha Centauri. And, you know, it takes people all this time to write me this spurnful note to say, you know, you're such a freak for trying to make us believe this when all you got to do is a quick search. You know, they sent a Doritos commercial to Ursa Major. They sent The Day the Earth Stood Still, which arrived in Alpha Centauri December 21st, 2012, which makes it even more unbelievable. So the levels that people will accept and not accept, you know, talking about human cloning, transhumanism, and the lay of, I mean, we have glow-in-the-dark cats. I mean, come on. They just combined a pig with a human and producing body parts. We, you know, what does it take for people to say, okay, this is the direction life is going? It doesn't matter what political spectrum, right? This story keeps going.
Yeah, it does. It does. And, you know, I have the same experience as you do. People will write and say, well, that's crazy. I just don't believe it. And my response to them is go out and read my books. Go out and do the research. You know, my books are extensively footnoted. If you don't believe me, just go follow the footnotes.
There's a long list of books, folks. A long list. Well-researched, well-databased. I've got a number of them myself. Absolutely, get over to GizaDeathStar.com and check out the massive list. And, you know, it just seems that so much. I'm gonna try not to get too far out of the picture here, but it seems that so much of this technology that we're talking about boils up out of the occult.
I think some of it does, at least. To the extent that it's a process that I think really begins in earnest inside of Nazi Germany, not so much out of the occult, but simply because they were interested in looking at all sorts of ancient texts, be they occult or otherwise, and trying to figure out if there was some sort of scientific basis to them. And, you know, I personally don't think it takes much imagination to look at some of those ancient texts, Epic of Ninurta, Edfu, temple texts, and so on, Gilgamesh, things like this, to realize that you're dealing with descriptions of technologies there in the best language they had available to them. So, you know, I really don't have much of a problem with that idea. And the other aspect of this is we have to take into consideration that if you are funding black projects with trillions of dollars of completely off the books money, and people think I'm talking about the black budget. I'm not talking about the black budget because that has at least a minimal sort of congressional oversight. I'm talking about a completely hidden system that is in the hands of the intelligence community with no oversight. So we're talking about, since the end of World War II, we're talking about trillions of dollars over that amount of time, if not perhaps even quadrillions of dollars. So you put enough money and enough people into investigating things, and one of the things they're going to do is they're going to look at ancient texts, and they're also going to look at the history of the development of modern physics with a fine-toothed comb to see if there's anything they missed or if there was a mistake in something. You know, let's remember Ben Rich, the former head of the Lockheed Skunk Works, allegedly at his death said, well, yeah, we found an error in the equations, and now we can take E.T. home. You know, for the head of Lockheed Skunk Works to say something like this, you know, you better sit up and take notice. And I'm thinking, well, okay, whose equations? You know?
Right.
What was the error? You know? But yeah, you've got statements like this. You've got all these little indicators. If you put them all in a big basket, you've got all these little indicators something is up. DARPA's, you know, 100-year warp goal, NASA's actual warp experiment projects that are being headed by Dr. White. You've got statements of this or that group wanting their fusion reactors. You've got the German fusion reactor now has has successfully passed its second proof of concept experiment. You know, all this stuff is going on. And then let's add to it, add to this data set, the fact that the Rockefeller Foundation, I think last year, divested itself of all of its petroleum interests. That's a huge clue, folks, that there's something coming down the pike.
Wow. Yes. I mean, these type of what I know of as jumping Jesus effects, the something that just is world shattering and changes life forever and ever. These are the type of things that we're talking about here. Right. Warp drive. You know, of course, transhumanism and the politics of immortality, that's right. Obviously going to change a lot of things if we can start right. living that long.
Well, yeah, this is the other thing. That's a good topic to take note of, because if you look at the financial system, the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, I think it was at the G20 summit in China a couple of years ago, came out and just very, very bluntly said that the debt growth finance model is over. There is no way forward that is not a reform. Now, that's a huge statement for a major power finance minister to make.
Break that down a little bit, because I don't really understand.
Well, what he's saying is that our current system of monetized debt has been pushed as far as it can go, that there's no way forward with this system. In other words, let's look at it in terms of finance capital versus equity capital. What the Western system has become in the last 30 years is making a bunch of money off of stock trades, derivative trades, and transactions, but it has not led to a real increase in productivity. So in other words, there's no way to grow the system simply on the basis of finance capital anymore. There has to be real production. There has to be real equity.
Real value.
There have to be real jobs. And this is exactly what President Trump is saying. So that's one factor here that we have to keep in mind. But the other factor is if you are bringing in new technologies, new energies, let's just stop and think of fusion for a moment. This means you will no longer have to dig oil, coal, or natural gas out of the ground. that's huge right there.
Yeah, robot labor.
Right.
And what are we all going to be doing?
Yeah, well, exactly. This is the other thing. The technology is creating now a leisure class that's not confined to the super rich. In fact, the leisure class now has spread out to encompass the lower classes and the middle classes. You're going to have to have some way to roll all that debt that's in the system and all the entitlements that are in the system. So in other words, you're going to have a way to harvest the wealth of people to balance the books. And one way to do this is, of course, life extension. If you live much longer and are paying into the system much longer, this is absolutely one way to do it. You've got a lot of this debt. And the other thing that people have to understand is you're kind of looking, you know, Catherine Fitz calls it the transition from a finance system of global 1.0 to global 3.0. In other words, you're having to restructure the entire system because of these emerging technologies, because of the limitations now of the monetized debt growth model, which has run its course. We can't advance any further with it. We have to start talking about production. So in other words, this is the other thing I think that they're pushing space for. This is the reason I think they're pushing the idea of virtual immortality. Now, there's another factor to this, and that's labor productivity versus human productivity. This is not something that most people understand, but labor productivity would be things that you and I are familiar with. In other words, production in actual jobs, like, you know, making steel or rolling out cars on an assembly line or pouring concrete for a housing project. That would be considered labor productivity by the economists. Human productivity would be things like having a rock group on a concert tour or composing a symphony and monetizing it and so on and so forth. So in other words, human productivity is an aspect of the economy that economists very seldom look at, either in their thinking or in their planning. But as you say, robots and things, 3D printing, all of this stuff coming online, the actual labor productivity jobs outside of some very skilled areas is going to drop. I saw an email somebody sent me of an ATM at a McDonald's. It's an ATM, literally, quite literally, a Big Mac ATM. Put in your money and out pops your soda and your fries and your hamburger.
I've always said you'd get a better product that way.
Yeah, well, it doesn't take much. But
exactly. I mean, nobody likes these jobs, you know?
Right.
They're not there because they love making you a burger, which... You know, again, that taking this love out of the equation as well is something that we're going to get into in the next hour, folks, and getting into the ideas of what is beauty, what is life, what is human, and taking this a little bit further so that we can understand what kind of civilization we actually want to create. Because, Joseph, I would say right now, we are not conditioned for leisure time. I don't see that in people. They are not ready for leisure time.
No, they're not. And this, you know, but by the nature of the case, and I've talked about this, and people think I'm nuts. You know, I've talked about this quite a lot with Catherine Fitz and some other people, that as you see the labor productivity component of the financial and economic picture dwindle, people are going to be forced by the nature of the case to monetize the human productivity. In other words, I think you literally are going to have to see an explosion in the arts, in culture, where people are monetizing that kind of creativity in a very, very different way. And this is not unusual. If we go back, if you know, we're in one of those 500-year cyclic transitions that happens in Western society about once every 500 years. But what we're going through now, Freeman, I think is not only quantitatively but qualitatively different than anything humans have been through in the entirety of their history. It's that huge. And there really isn't any precedent.
Right.
In that history for what we're going through. And this is why economists and planners and so on are having such difficulty making predictions, because their models are simply not working for what we're going through. And the other part of the reason that their models aren't working is simply that financially they are ignoring the existence of this huge hidden system of finance. So their predictions never work because they're ignoring about 50% of the picture.
Right.
It's literally a material omission. You know, Catherine Fitz has been hammering at this. She and I came to that, to the same conclusion about this hidden system, but by very different routes. But the bottom line is if you ignore it, none of your predictions will make sense because you're only looking at 50% of the financial circuit, so to speak. So, yeah, I think by the nature of the case, people are going to be sort of forced into human productivity. And that could turn out to be a good thing because it's culture that ultimately humanizes us.
Right.
I don't know about you, but I don't particularly want to have a half pig, half human for my children. You know,
I've got a pig heart.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there is an anti-human agenda going on, but I think that because of the nature of the case, the picture that we're looking at financially and technologically, I think there's going to be a big cultural pushback, and it's going to come from that human productivity side.
Yes.
If we're allowed to do it. If we see the Islamicization of Western culture, well, I don't know about you, but I'm not terribly thrilled with the idea of having to pay a jizya tax to listen to John Lennon or J.S. Bach.
There you go.
You know, because you know, they have texts in their music that are just totally, completely opposed to that ideology.
Right.
You know, so I think we have to understand we're in a culture war as well. And
can you imagine, I'm sorry, but an Islamic smart house?
No, I can't.
Telling you, you know, you can't say that. You can't.
You know, I get people charging me all sorts of things for what I think about Islam, you know, from racist to xenophobe to all of this and that and the other. I just recently read a story about Madeleine Albright wanting to convert to Islam to show solidarity. Well, Madeleine, I've got news for you. If you want to show solidarity, convert and go live in Saudi Arabia.
Right. Yes.
You know, if you think it's that glorious and that tolerant of a culture, go experience it firsthand. Western culture, and I've said this many times, and it's an oversimplification, I'll grant you, but Western culture is based on three things that have contributed to this very complex culture we have. Judaism and the idea of contract, of a covenant, of a contract. Christianity with the idea of reason or logos becoming incarnate. And that invites its own critique, because if you don't believe that story, then you have to have reasons for it. Harmony and so on. All of that is implicit in the metaphysical and philosophical presuppositions of Christianity. And then the third component would be the Renaissance humanism, the early kind of enlightenment, where critique and free expression become a part of that culture along with the other two elements. And this has created something absolutely unique. And the problem with Western culture is when any one of those three components of it gains too much cultural influence, then the civilization begins to break down. So, you know, this is why I tell people you've got to start understanding this culture, because now we're in a life and death struggle. Every one of us now is responsible for knowing the high institutions of that civilization and culture, and to pass down as much of it as we can.
It's time to pull out your Renaissance, folks, and get out the art and find out what's human. I mean, if you want to take it to the dark side, then, you know, watch Battlestar Galactica and see where this all can go. What do you got coming up, Joseph? You're working so hard on your blogs and podcasts there at GizaDeathStar.com. Anything else coming up this year?
Well, I am researching a couple of books. I had planned to try and get two more books out this year, but one of the subjects I'm researching, and I never tell people what I'm researching. I've learned the hard way, so I'm sorry, but I am researching some books. But one of them is proving to be quite a piece of research. So I will be lucky if I get one out this year, but I am planning to do, I've got a whole lot of books. I still want to write before I croak, but, I'm planning to do another one, hopefully get it out sometime this year.
Yeah, folks, get over there. Check out the Giza Death Star, SS Brotherhood of the Bell, Nazi International, Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, because this is the future. And this is far beyond all the identity politics that we're watching erupt right now. All of this isn't going to matter once we start getting warp drives and, Google already is running around with killer robots and AI technology with quantum computers. I mean, the future is here. It's happening now. And it's true that if this was turned in the right direction, the leisure time that came to humanity would open our culture to just leaps and bounds. I mean, never before in humanity's existence have we ever had this open knowledge, this amount of data that we can take in. You know, start building your library, start building your music collection, start building these things that are going to fulfill you while you're sitting back enjoying life eternally.
And not only that, I would say monetize your artistic creativity in some fashion and make sure that it does humanize people. I posted, it's interesting, Freeman, I posted on my website in my community forum a little video that I found on YouTube called "Why is Modern Art So Bad?"
Yes.
And I can't tell you the response I had to that. It was overwhelming. And I pointed out that so much modern art really is not art, it's anti-art. And I posted some musical examples of this anti-art impulse, which is ultimately dehumanizing. One of the music examples I posted were five piano pieces by the so-called classical composer Arnold Schoenberg. And then after, you know, and people said, oh, that's awful. I couldn't stand to listen to but more than 15 seconds of it. And yeah, it is awful. Like, you know, I'm one of those that if the emperor has no clothes, I say he has no clothes. You know, I don't go along with these so-called intellectuals that bow before this type of anti-art and say it's sublime, it's wonderful, it's meaningful. No, it's just trash. But this video points out that precisely we've had in the movement from the 18th to the 20th centuries, we've had a movement from the transcendental, the beautiful, the sublime, the mysterious, the mystical, the mystagogical, to the trashy, the banal, the scatological.
Welcome to the life of the mediocre.
Yeah, welcome to the life of the mediocre, and this is what we see in our culture. So I posted Schoenberg, these pieces by Schoenberg, and then after that, I posted a video of Nora the cat playing the piano. Literally, a cat sitting on a piano bench and just plunking the keys.
Right.
You know, and people responded, I'd rather listen to Nora the cat.
Yeah. So, yes.
There you go. That says it all right
It
there.
Really, really does. Well, folks, you know, tomorrow's the Super Bowl. We'll see if my predictions come true or not. And we're going to take this very topic that we're on right now and the idea of why is the modern art so bad and take this to what it really means to be human with Joseph Farrell. So thank you all so much for being here and tuning in. And I hope that you are going to join the fight and help us share, because we really need you now that they've taken over the internet and nothing's making it through the algorithms. We need you more than ever to share and to click notify. I guess I should mention I will start my 9th Facebook profile eventually. They keep kicking me off, Joseph. It's like, I'm just so tired of going back and getting all my friends back. You know, 5,000 friends, that's a lot of clicking. So, yeah, I am off Facebook again, but follow me on Twitter, Freeman TV. Follow Joseph on Twitter. What's your Twitter? Do you know?
I don't know because I seldom pay attention to it. It's just something automatically linked from my website.
All right. Well, I'll reshare you a lot more, and that way people will be able to find you and follow you. So I want to thank you all so much for keeping this show going for so long. Keep getting people coming to freemantv.com. Absolutely get out and check out GizaDeathStar.com. And thank you for sharing everything. And right now I am pushing for subscribers. I'm pushing for you guys to kind of generate a little more cash flow for me because I am going to try and move to a TV studio in Northern Florida. I'm going to go check it out next week. So I'll let you all know how that goes. Now, WQXT has been a huge fan of the Freeman Perspective and Freeman TV for 12 years, so they're very excited to get me into their cable network. So it's a, you know, it's a done deal. There's no money involved in this, folks. I'm not getting paid, never have. All of my support comes from you. So if you want to see me in a TV studio, then subscribe. Get over to freemantv.com, sign up. If you don't want to subscribe, you can get all these great shows on the 8 GB flash drive, get the full shows and all 2 hours of everything and more on there, 8 GB, or the DVDs and all of the products that I have there that will help support me get going. I just need your help right now. So if you want to jump in, jump on, just it's $7, you know, it's no big deal, and you'll get all the information that you could possibly know, and you'll get to see me rise up a bit more and maybe get noticed a little bit more. And hopefully you want my message to spread. I sure hope so. I want Joseph Farrell's message to spread. This is One Smart Guy, folks, and I can't wait till we're going to get back up on the other side. So we will see you all next week, and we'll discuss what might just happen. Well, next week, Dr. Sala, we're going to get deep into Antarctica and all of the strange breakaway civilization stuff we can there. So tune in next week for that. We will see you all next week.